And our final speaker of this morning is Dr. Michael Oxman. Dr. Oxman received his MD from Harvard Medical School and has worked both on the East and now on the West Coast of the United States. His major research interests have been in herpes viruses, and he pioneered the use of double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trials to evaluate the treatment of herpes simplex and varicella zoster virus infections. He's prolific throughout his work life, and we are very thrilled to have him here because he is the person to talk about shingles vaccine, because he was the lead author and the national chairman of the VA cooperative study that looked at the efficacy of zoster vaccine. So welcome.
Monica, thank you. Thank you very much. I really appreciate the invitation. When you said I was prolific, I thought you were going to say prolific with slides, which unfortunately I am. So I'll see if I can move quickly through them. So I'm going to talk to you about the shingles vaccine, which is really a change of pace in a sense. And the first question, of course, is why bother and why do we need it? One reason, and I didn't get the Canadian figures, but one reason is that there are more than 1 million cases of shingles each year in the United States, and that is going to be an increasing problem as we have an increasingly aging population. Pain is a major manifestation of herpes zoster. There's prodromal pain, which I think is underappreciated as a challenge for differential diagnosis, because until the rash appears, I think only God can diagnose shingles. Pain during the acute phase is very common, particularly in older people, and persisting pain, which was the motivation for our beginning this endeavor in 1991, post-herpetic neuralgia is long-lasting pain, which can have a devastating effect on the lives of older people who've worked hard and have finally retired and are looking forward to having a good time, and this can interfere with that significantly. Now, one component, a word that I didn't know the meaning of until relatively recently, which is present in over 90% of people with postherpetic neuralgia, is allodynia. And that is a fancy term for stimuli that ordinarily don't cause pain, like light touch or a breeze blowing on your forehead, inducing very significant pain and discomfort, enough to make people stop playing tennis because running to the net, if they have ophthalmic zoster, running to the net is intolerably painful, enough to keep people from putting a shirt on because the touch of the shirt on their skin is intolerably painful. Now, the reason I think why we need a shingles vaccine is because, despite all the meta-analyses and everything else, the bottom line is once shingles develops, the available treatments don't reliably prevent post-herpetic neuralgia. And I'll show you a little bit of data from the shingles prevention study, which makes that clear. And so antiviral therapy is an important thing to use as fast as you can, but it has an impact primarily on the acute phase of the disease and relatively little on long-term pain. Corticosteroids early on were thought to offer something because of the involvement of immunopathology in the cause of postherpetic neuralgia, but in fact steroids have absolutely no effect on postherpetic neuralgia. They have a modest effect on pain and activities of daily living and quality of life in the early phase of the disease, but the best study, and that is by the late Martin Woods et al. About 10 years ago in the New England Journal of Medicine, make it clear that the side effects and life-threatening side effects in older people taking high-dose steroids significantly outweigh the modest benefits. And so I essentially don't use them. And finally, those of you who are involved with a care or relative of anybody who has significant postherpetic neuralgia recognize that no treatment is really awfully good, and all of the treatments are particularly problematic in an older population. Now, I just want to point out that vaccination against shingles presents a unique challenge. In general, with viral infections, we, and chickenpox is a good example, with vaccination against chickenpox, we're inducing immunity before exogenous exposure to the virus. So we're immunizing people before the development of disease. We expect high efficacy, and we hope for and often get herd immunity, as I'll show you in a minute. So in 1996, universal one-dose immunization against chickenpox, not shingles, chickenpox, was introduced in the United States and shifted to a two-dose policy in 2006. And vaccine coverage has reached over 90% in the United States for varicella. And the result is very interesting. First of all, as expected, and this is CDC data, American CDC data, with Jane Seward and her colleagues. Oops, how do I go back? Nope. Sorry. With Jane Seward and her colleagues, showing that there's about a 90% reduction in serious disease and chickenpox, no matter how you measure it. But importantly, in red, in the population of older people who are not vaccinated, there's also a marked reduction. So eliminating chickenpox in children eliminates exposure of those adults who have managed to get to adulthood without being infected. So this is a good example of herd immunity. Now, in contrast, when we attempt to vaccinate against shingles, we're trying to vaccinate against a disease that's caused by a virus that we already have on board. So we're already immune to chickenpox when we're vaccinated against shingles. And so what we really have to do is to change the virus-host interaction. And that's been a tall order. And if we hope to vaccinate against recurrent herpes, against HIV/AIDS or the consequences of infection, and even against hepatitis C after people are infected, major challenges, we're going to have the same problem. So in that setting, when we're talking about trying to immunize people against a disease that's caused by reactivation of endogenous virus that's already on board, we don't expect that kind of efficacy. And we certainly don't expect herd immunity because the source of the virus is internal, not external. Now, why do we think that there's any chance of this working? It sounds like an awfully long shot. And why did we think that? Well, the reasons are pathogenesis, epidemiology, and the development by Takahashi and his colleagues of the most attenuated of all live attenuated virus vaccines. Now, I just want to take a minute to contrast herpes simplex, which we all have a pretty good understanding of, and herpes zoster. And in herpes simplex, which is, I think I'm not doing a good job, which is here on the left, the virus reactivates in a neuron, but it doesn't appear to spread. It appears to go down the axon from that neuron to the skin, and there's no evidence, clinically or otherwise, of extensive pathology in the ganglion itself. And remarkably for this most destructive virus, it looks as if the neuron that's infected in which the virus reactivates not only transmits it to the skin, but it doesn't appear even to die. So that there are people who are in their 90s who've had scores and scores of episodes of recurrent herpes simplex. They have no loss of sensation. They have no postherpetic neuralgia. And they get it in the same place. And although there's overlapping innervation, there's not that much overlap. So that really indicates that with herpes simplex, the virus is reactivating but not killing, not damaging the ganglion and not even killing the nerve cell in which it reactivates. Now, in contrast with varicella zoster virus, the virus appears to reactivate in the neuron just as herpes simplex does, but it spreads in the ganglion And this is something that's been recognized since the 1850s, and the best data is in the Head and Campbell paper in 1900. And the person who knows more about this than anybody that I know of living in the world now is Peter Watson in Toronto. And what happens when varicella zoster virus reactivates, it spreads. It causes a spreading infection in the ganglion, which results in two things. It results in hemorrhagic necrosis in the ganglion, and it also results in many neurons being infected. So when the virus gets to the skin, it's coming down the axons to many neurons and involves a large part of the dermatome.